Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Garden State Debate podcast and videocast. Today, I'm excited to have back a previous guest again, Michelle Sikirica of the New Jersey Business and Industry Association, NJBIA. She actually originally joined us back in fall of 2020. And we ran down a number of things, kind of basically overview her perspective on the business climate in New Jersey as she saw it currently, which was obviously in the middle of COVID. And we're still in the throes of that. So I'm sure that'll be part of the discussion today. But please check out the first discussion that we had. If you haven't already, but just a little background on NJBIA for those who haven't checked in. It's been over 100 years in existence, I think 1910, and they support over 1 million employees, if that's still the correct number. In the state of New Jersey, the largest organization that supports small businesses in the state. Michelle is the CEO and head of NJBIA and president. So we're hoping to have another dynamic discussion. I think a lot, probably some similar overlapping things from last time, and I'm sure a lot of new stuff. There's been a lot that's gone on, but I don't want to waste any more time, but also congratulations, Michelle, on a number of things, but including being listed as in the top 20 there of the Insider 100 policymakers list so that for 2021. So welcome to the show. I'm glad to have you back. Thanks for making the time out to come on.
It's my pleasure, Ryan. Thanks so much.
Great. So just to jump into it real quickly. So what's going on? Maybe we can start with the state budget. We spent a lot of time last year talking about what was going on as New Jersey pushed its fiscal year back, and there was obviously stimulus involved in certain borrowing and emergency borrowings and things like that. So if you don't mind, can you just give us your quick snapshot of this fall, the 2021-22 state budget that was passed, I believe about a month ago, maybe a little bit more. What did you like about it? What didn't you like? What would you like to have seen more of? Like, what were the things that jumped out to you?
Yeah. So, first of all, this is an increased budget. So we continue to spend more and more money each and every year. In fact, over the last 4 years, our overall budget has increased over 30%. Which, you know, you think about that, it's not very sustainable. So let's start with what we like about the budget, right? What we liked about it was the full pension payment. We can only make that full pension payment because we borrowed $4.4 billion last year, which we did not need to borrow. We said we were needed to borrow it because of COVID, and yet we realized that our income to our general fund actually, you know, overachieved despite COVID, and that was because of the increase in corporate business tax in particular. And a few other, you know, spending continued to be pretty good on the consumer side. You know, as all that federal stimulus money went into the pockets of New Jersey citizens, they turned around, they spent that money in the economy. And so we saw sales tax and corporate business tax were well. But also, you know, we had a brand new millionaire's tax. And so certainly, you know, the millionaire's tax and the corporate business tax caused absolutely overachievement in revenues, which we called it. We knew that was going to happen. We said, don't borrow that money. But you know, so with that money, the one good thing was that full pension payment, right? The concern in this budget is funding of items potentially that we won't have revenue in the future to fund, right? Because we also used a portion of our other federal stimulus money in this budget. Some of the rescue money is set aside to be used in this budget. That Rescue Act money needs to be used. It's one-time pot of money. It needs to be used for one-time purposes. That will stimulate our economy. It cannot be used to fund or start any new program that would need sustained funding into the future, or else that means that we'll have to raise taxes in the future to continue that. So, you know, there's some good stuff in budget. There's some infrastructure investments. You know, on the whole, our biggest concern with it is just the sheer amount of money that we are spending here in the state and ensuring that we're not creating new programs that are not sustainable in the future.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks for that. And just to jump off that on the some of the stimulus money, last time we talked about CARES Act, now we're talking about American Rescue Act funding. You just mentioned, you know, it's a one-time pot of money. It's meant for specific things. Are we spending it? Do you have any insight into how quickly New Jersey is spending it relative to other states and what it's being earmarked for? And is there kind of like a shot clock on when that will run out? I think, what do we have, a couple of years, something like that?
The Rescue Act money we have through 2024 to spend, which is actually good because we can, you know, use it in multi-year, you know, multi-year program in order to fill gaps, if you will. So, you know, no, we have no idea how the money is going to be spent because there's no plan. We don't plan in New Jersey. We wake up every day and we do block and tackle. There's no comprehensive plan, which we've been calling for, frankly, and we're very frustrated about as a business community. We have advanced recommendations to invest this money in workforce development because the jobs of the future are here right now. And we don't have the skill set in people in order to fill the jobs. We have tens of thousands of vacant jobs all across the state of New Jersey. Either people aren't coming back to that labor market because they don't want to take those frontline jobs anymore. But the jobs that require skill are lacking an educated workforce with the skill set needed to fill those jobs. And so workforce development is a huge investment that's needed. We also want to see that money invested in properly in infrastructure. Infrastructure drives jobs. And that infrastructure can be broad, but it has to be pure infrastructure, actually, you know, bricks and sticks and mortar and not operational, you know, types of things. And then we want to see that money also invested in innovation and technology. You know, let's take, for example, we are in the fourth industrial revolution, as they say, but this is the technological revolution. And I always love quoting Dr. Joel Bloom from NJIT. He said that what we're seeing experiencing today in 2021, we weren't supposed to experience until about 2024. And so we need the labor force to be up on, you know, those technical skills. But on the technology side, technology is going to empower and enable our rebound and our economic solutions. And so we need to put money toward technology solutions for business to readapt their business models for today, for the jobs that people won't come back to. And we need to ensure that business gets money in order to update their technology properly.
Okay. And as it relates, I mean, there's a couple of things I wanted to talk about that kind of mentioned as it relates to wages, labor, things like that. So do we have New Jersey unemployment rates, what, up around 7%, right? 7%. The national average is around 5.5 or 5, low fives. And New Jersey extended its unemployment benefits beyond other states, but also so did New York and others. So is there any correlation that you're seeing between unemployment benefits, labor? I mean, labor shortages, wage growth. I know that's a lot of different things, but like, how would you put that together for, like, you know, the common person that's trying to think about what's going on here in New Jersey as it relates to small businesses and employment?
Yeah, so we have an unprecedented hiring crisis that continues here in the state of New Jersey. Tens of thousands of vacant jobs, but as you just said, 7.2% unemployment. So you kind of scratch your head and you go, how can we have that disconnect? There's more jobs out there than people, you know, able to fill them. And yet we've got 7.2% of the labor who is not coming back to work, right? So we do believe that, you know, this was there were a lot of reasons for this, right? The federal unemployment enhancement, the $300 per week, certainly contributed, was an aggravating factor, no doubt about it. But in addition to that was childcare challenges. You know, we have had childcare challenges all through the pandemic. Because childcare facilities, even though they were able to be open 100%, still had certain license restrictions that affected their ability to staff up in order to provide the supply to the demand. And so we literally had families and kids waiting on the sidelines with no place to place their children, right? Hopefully now that school is back in session and students are back in school and the $300 is gone, we're hoping that we'll see some easing of this challenge, but it's going to be some weeks, if not a couple months, to see what the, you know, impact of that's going to be. Other aggravating factor was the almost loss, if you will, of our J-1 visa program, which supports our tourism industry and seasonal workers each and every year. We have thousands of J-1 visa workers who come to New Jersey to supplement the summer workforce. And this year, if we had 100, we would have been lucky, okay? The program, it's a federal program. So, you know, our state policymakers can't necessarily pull a trigger on that. However, we did ask our state policymakers to be more verbose, if you will, with the president on the need for this program to get up to speed quickly because of our needs here in New Jersey. I do a shout out though to our federal delegation who did work hard on this and continues to work hard on this. We have some heavy advocacy into and through the federal delegation right now on, you know, on that issue. The other piece of this also is, again, I mentioned before, people aren't coming back to the jobs that they left. They've chosen over the last year to say, I don't want to do that anymore, right? I'm going to wait for the next opportunity to come along. Well, to that regard, we say, go get skilled up workforce, right? And we're not seeing an increase in enrollment in, per se, our community colleges or our training centers for people to get these skills. So everybody has a responsibility here, Ryan, right? The employer always has a responsibility to provide a competitive and safe work environment, right? And somewhere that people want to be attracted to work and stay. The workforce has an obligation though too. Workforce has an obligation to, you know, get skilled up, get trained and show up. Jobs are sustainable, unemployment isn't. And you know, we're asking our workforce, you know, please, our employers need you. You need to come back. And then of course, our policymakers have a role in this as well. We've asked our policymakers for 6 months now to bring more relief to the business community in order, in the height of the tourism season, maybe to provide some retention and recruitment bonuses so businesses could get people back that have been, you know, more attractive than $300 per week was per se. Tax credits for those who advance wages beyond minimum wage. You know, we had a lot of strategies into our policymakers on that.
Okay. Yeah, that's quite a bit. And it's just, there's so many factors like that you just ran through pretty quickly that go into it. So it's hard to kind of grasp the labor shortage as it relates to the available jobs, right? So people could think when they read, oh, unemployment's high. You know, we have 8 million less people employed than we had before the pandemic, but yet there's 12 million or 11.5 million open available jobs. So I know you said a lot of things there. Is there one thing that sticks out, one or two? What does it boil down to? Are wages too low? Is it the unemployment benefits were greater than some wages? Should there be an increase in the minimum wage? Things like that. Is there anything that sticks out to you? Because there's obviously a disconnect. And then I guess a further question is, if wages continue to go up, but the labor force is not fulfilled, could we potentially see some more inflation that could cause other external impacts on New Jersey residents and companies?
No, the answer to all of that is yes. So, you know, when you had the $300 on top of, you know, the unemployment, if you were receiving the max benefit in unemployment and you had $300 on top of it, you were making upwards of $1,000 a week, okay? Upwards of $1,000 a week, do the math, all right? Entry-level positions were not paying that. So sure, policymakers would turn to me and say, Michelle, your companies don't pay enough money. And I'm like, you can't pay $30 for someone to cook a hamburger or to wash the dishes, right? That's not a sustainable business model. That's why those are entry-level positions, right? So, and therein is where, you know, technology is gonna start to take the place of some of those jobs. Because it's not that technology is going to replace the person. It's that the person didn't come back. Now we must automate in order to, you know, fulfill our ability to be sustainable, you know, into the future. So that's, you know, one major aspect of that and the impact on that. And yes, the jobs change. If there's one thing I could put my finger on right now of what's needed, again, we need workforce development skills built, and we need the workforce to skill themselves up. Our employers are investing in it each and every day. People go and they, you know, they join a company, they get a position, and we're upskilling. You know, our companies are creating internships and apprenticeships and on-the-job training. But the workforce has to come along and lean into that as well and go get the training that they need to earn, because you know what, Brian? When you increase your skills, you organically increase your earning potential, right? When you increase your skills, you organically increase your earning potential. You can't just sit at one level with no skills and expect someone to keep throwing money at that position. That's not sustainable. And so if people want to increase their earning capacity, they need to increase their skills. And we have buku ways to do that here in the state of New Jersey.
That's exactly what I was going to kind of ask. And you've talked about it a little bit. And I think you said that a lot of the American Rescue Act funds could go towards, workplace skill development on top of what you said in terms of you said your business clientele are investing in it from their side. So it like is from a workforce perspective to, again, you said community colleges, universities, some folks don't go to college. There's, and then you have trade schools. Like from what I've seen during the pandemic specifically, you know, we had the technology, technology driven events brought up, like fast forwarded to now, like you said, that could have been, might've happened in 4 or 5 years from now. But at the same time, it seemed like there was a high demand for like trade type of work, contract type of work, things like that. So is there an opportunity there where, is there a stigma that people need to go to community college or to college in general? Or is there an opportunity in New Jersey for more trade oriented, small business, which, eventually become small businesses in the state of New Jersey? Is that something that you'd like to see more of? Or how do you see that kind of impacted through COVID?
We've been on a campaign for years around skilling up folks in the trades. Pre-COVID, we had tens of thousands of open jobs in the pure trades, and people were not, so we've had this whole, paradigm for such a long time that, the only way you advance is by going to four-year college and getting a degree and going on from there, right? And the reality is you can earn and learn at the same time. And rather than your educational trajectory being, K-16 like this, you can do on and off ramps, where you get a certificate and you get a job and you get another certificate and you get another job. And, we've had a campaign around educating New Jersey's workforce and future workforce on the value of community college, trade schools, and these types of positions. I could tell you, a welder, for example, in a manufacturing facility can earn over $100,000. That's no joke. Electricians, plumbers, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, okay? You have students coming out with bachelor's degrees and they're going and working in restaurants. So,
And a lot of student debt.
With a lot of student debt, absolutely. In fact, New Jersey, our last run of data, we were the fourth highest student debt state in the nation, right?
Are you a proponent of some student debt relief or anything related to easing the cost of tuition at, is that something?
So, well, looking forward, absolutely. I mean, we led and lead a workforce development coalition that works on attractability and affordability of post-secondary education here in the state of New Jersey. And we believe that there are affordable ways to get post-secondary, meaning, after high school education. We put out a report back in 2016 called the Education Equation, and we just released the Education Equation 2.0 last week. That has remedies and strategies. Our first report, we had 13 recommendations, 12 of which have been practically 100% accomplished, okay? So there's real strategies out there to be able to do this. And the key really is educating, our future workforce on those opportunities.
Excellent, very good. I'm sure we'll jump around a little bit, but I just wanted to ask you about your thoughts on just over the past year and a half or more, the quote unquote shift of employers and kind of the shift outside of New York City, I would say, for example, whether it be satellite offices and you already talked about technology, maybe it's work from home and some skilled type of positions, finance, technology, all those types of industries. Are you seeing that shift? And is it any of it coming to New Jersey? I know from speaking to friends and family that there are plenty of companies in New York City that are moving. are basically moving a lot of their workforce off of New York City into satellite offices, whether, you know, it's Florida, Texas, sometimes New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, other places. So is New Jersey stacking up well in that? Have you seen any of it?
Well, I think you can see just from the housing market in New Jersey, which is on fire, that there's a lot of movement, for sure. So we have been the beneficiary of people, you know, coming out of New York, the leasing, even, you know, rentals. If you have to rent an apartment, you better start 3 months ahead of time. I just saw my own son who's moving from one apartment to another. You know, the pent up demand is extraordinary. But I think more so what we see is, I think what we're going to see in the future is a change in business model. We're seeing it already, right? Many businesses, if you have the ability to have a remote workforce, you're not in manufacturing, you're not a frontline customer facing, you know, on a main street. If you can do that, you are leaning more into hybrid. Having your staff in 50% of the time and allowing remote work from whatever location, you know, the other 50%. You know, pre-COVID, our next generation workforce was looking for that flexibility, and companies weren't so quick to lean in. Well, when you were thrown into it in COVID with no choice but to keep your operation running remotely if you wanted to keep your operation going, I think that many employers learned and understood that there is value. And that there is effectiveness and efficiencies that can be attained. And if you have a trust culture in your work environment, you can trust your employee, you know, to work from home and get their job done. You know, the downside of that is certainly communication and collaboration takes a little bit of a backseat when you're working remote. And that's why the hybrid model is probably going to be the successful model for the future, because you have to have people, you know, teaming in person. There's just this one dimension, you know, interaction only goes so far. And there are absolutely needs for engagement of collaboration and teamwork that require teams to be in person. So, you know, we see that in the commercial real estate market of people limiting their footprint, if you will, taking smaller space, consolidating because half their workforce is, they're doing like AB schedules, and therefore they don't need, you know, the huge buildings anymore.
All right. Thanks. And you briefly touched on it, and it's, like you said, it's related to employment and the economy, the red hot housing market of New Jersey and many other places across the country. It's obviously a positive for people that own homes. It could be a challenging thing for people that are retiring or younger folks that are, you know, going into the workforce. And also, I just want to get your take on that. Is there enough affordable housing in the state of New Jersey, A, if it's so red hot? And then B, is this a temporary red hot situation because people are leaving urban areas? Or is it more of a paradigm shift that might continue into less dense areas, where the densest state in the nation? So, and also, like, and one last thing to kind of throw in there, wages, inflation, things are going to cost more. What if interest rates go up and our home values go down? Then what happens?
So, you know, we 18 to 34 year olds continue to be the largest out-migration group from the state of New Jersey, and that's an affordability factor. You know, we graduate our high school seniors, and overwhelming majority of them leave the state. Now, I will say, because of COVID, many have stayed closer to home. Right? They didn't necessarily want to go away. But historically, you know, we are like, that's the number one out migration group in the nation, is 18 to 34 year olds leaving the state of New Jersey. It's our future workforce. We should be concerned about that. Affordability is an extraordinary challenge for someone who's just getting their first job out of school. The rents in the state of New Jersey are, you know, just off the charts. You cannot find an apartment for, you know, under $1,000, and $1,000 a month, you're talking about the inner city, okay? And I'm not talking about the best neighborhood in the inner city. I mean, let's be fair. We've got great parts of our urban centers, and we've got some still challenging parts of our urban centers. And $1,000 a month is going to put you in a sketchy part of a neighborhood that you otherwise might not want to live in. So the rental side, no, we don't have enough available. But the other side of it is, you know, traditionally we say you make more money in New Jersey. So, but I just think that the cost of housing is out of whack with the what the entry level worker coming out of you know, maybe college or their first job can afford. Or, you know, just look at our some of our frontline workers, our healthcare workers, right? medical assistants, you know, starting up nurses, some of our teachers who are on the first, you know, step of their career. The money those folks are earning, they're hard pressed to put too much of that income to housing that straps them in other ways. So then, you know, you ask about inflation and I mean, we're experiencing that all over the place. So yes, the housing market is over hyperinflated right now, for sure. It is a seller's market. And I feel for anyone looking to buy a house today, because you're absolutely buying over asking price, because there's bidding wars. You hear it every day, and it's real. It's real. This isn't just anecdotal. It is real. The difference this time around from 2009 is in 2009, people were mortgaging in order to buy those hyperinflated houses. Today, they're using cash. All right. So that's a difference, that we don't think we're going to have a mortgage bubble, because people are willing to buy the risk in cash of the difference between what a house might assess for versus what they're willing to pay. So they're going to take the risk in the future, whether they're going to get that money back or not, because they just want that property now because they need it. And with houses, more so because, again, people are still remote working. They need more space, bigger space. So that's the difference between 2009 and now. And we are not thinking that we're going to see a mortgage bubble.
That's an interesting point on the mortgage bubble. And it kind of, if I'm hearing that, then I'm thinking, well, okay, so people are investing in actually living here, not just in housing in general, potentially. They're willing to pay over ask to be residents of the state of New Jersey, not to take advantage of some fluctuation potentially in the market. So while people are buying up homes and the market is hot, although it might be out of whack, are there things that we should be capitalizing on? We've already talked about some to keep those people coming in from, you know, West Coast. I've personally met plenty of people from San Francisco, LA, all over the place. They're coming to New Jersey. They love the schools, you know, public schools and things like that. You mentioned, you know, out migration of 18 to 34 year olds, but then we have this red hot housing market. But we're also, like, in some ways, we're like a suburb of New York in terms of our commuting patterns, which I'm sure drives a lot of the wealth. So, I mean, I guess that's not really a question, but how do we make sense of, other than the fact that it's not really a bubble, it's not a leveraged buying situation in the housing market, but do we think it's here to stay and we just need more of it in terms of like I said, affordable housing? Is that something that we should be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, right now it is the issue of who can afford to be here, okay?
Right.
Those that can afford to be here are here. And traditionally, yes, if you have school age children, this is the place to be. Number one K-12 system in the nation, right? However, we pay a premium for that. So, and that's why I say, if we pay a premium and we make that investment, we need to be able to keep those kids here on the other side, unless we want to just assume and accept that, you know, our economy is built on working school age families, because what you do see is then folks who are at or near, you know, the latter part of their career, absolutely, you know, leaving the state of New Jersey for more affordable living. And that's because of income tax and all those other costs, right? People with houses, who are selling the houses? Those who don't have school-age children anymore. Good news is right now we have school-age children families buying them. But I will tell you that there's going to be a dearth of that coming up, because we are anticipating, and demographers will tell you, that we're going to have about a decade worth of birth rates that are so low that our schools are going to see super decline in enrollment. And I wonder what that would do to the housing population, probably, you know, some years from now. What's driving that? Basically, the generation behind me and the generation behind them, and your generation, Ryan, you all are doing things 10 years later than we did them, right? We got married and started families in our 20-somethings. You all do that in your 30-somethings. That 10-year gap is going to be a huge demographic challenge for us. And it'll be interesting to see how it comes upon us, what we do with it, and where we are on the other side of it.
No, that's a good point. How about from a diversity point of view? Diversity of the state, diversity of demographics. When you look at your clients, is there certain demographics, certain parts of the state that are getting hit harder? I'm I'm twisting back into like the NJBIA clients and what they're talking about, what their issues are, who's potentially the most challenged right now. Can you talk a little bit about
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. So first of all, we're the most diverse state in the nation. So we start from there, right? And that has its pros and its cons for sure. But I will tell you the most significantly impacted population in the state of New Jersey today, and this is probably nationally as well, is the working mother. Now let's take that another level down, the minority working mother, okay? Significantly impacted through COVID. I have some statistics here that I thought you would find really interesting. So in May and June of 2020, one out of four women who became unemployed during the pandemic, right, suffered job loss because of the lack of childcare, right? Oh. Nationally, nearly 1.8 million women dropped out of the workforce entirely due to the pandemic, right? Those are startling statistics. Let's take that a step further. Businesses report that they suffer when parents face childhood challenges, and how so? 85% of primary caregivers of infants and toddlers said problems with childcare hurt their efforts or time commitment at work, productivity issue. And then small businesses, studies show that small businesses lose over $4 billion related to issues with childcare arrangements, while small business employees lose $8 billion in wages from the same cause, right? So you ask who's the most disparately impacted population in the state of New Jersey right now? It's the working mother, and that is tenfold for the minority working mother.
That's amazing to hear the actual numbers. And they're not anecdotal numbers, like you said, they're facts.
Anytime I cite data, it is from a source. We don't make it up for sure.
And I was looking before we spoke, before we started this discussion, and I was actually looking at the participation rate, people that are in the workforce in New Jersey. And it's somewhere around like 60, I wrote that down as well. 65-ish percent. It's 62%. It's 62%. Pre-pandemic was 65. And it hasn't been this low from the data I was looking at since like 1970s. So that kind of backs up what you just said, but from a higher level, you kind of give us more context around it, but the participation rate has significantly decreased, to your point, of people that are actively looking for jobs.
Participation, exactly, 62%. And the female labor force participation is lower than that. It's about 60%.
Wow. So not only do we have this disconnect of labor and wages and job openings, we also have a participation change related to the things that you mentioned. So it's a lot of moving parts for sure. That's why we had you on, the expert here, to break it down for us. Anything else coming out of NJBIA's clients in terms of, I know recent things, we're in mid-September right now, 2021. How about for example, President Biden with, I think I saw this actually from you in a couple editorials or quoted, vaccine mandates and, or testing. Not from obviously for a health perspective, but I saw your quotes related to the cost of having those things and what the impacts of the cost might be. So how do we wrap our heads around what you were trying to say or what you are saying and still all be extremely healthy and all that stuff?
So let's start from the premise that we did a pulse poll of our members to see where they stood on vaccines relative to their workplace, if they were contemplating, this was before Biden's order, if they were contemplating a mandate. And basically we learned that, the business community is split like right up on the middle on this, but one thing came out crystal clear. Business community wants to make these decisions for themselves based upon their work environment. So the physical environment, their workforce, right? The culture of the workforce, and then those that they serve, meaning the clients, okay? Good culture breeds good policy, but these employers want to be able to have these discussions with their employees and encourage their employees, right, to do what they may think is appropriate. They did not want a mandate. And with a mandate comes penalties and fines for a lack of compliance when businesses are doing the best they can to comply, right? So it's one thing to have a straight up black and white policy at the front and say, well, we should just do this. But why would we make the business owners the gatekeepers of this issue, right? If you want to vaccinate a population, go straight at the people who are not getting vaccinated, because now you've created another challenge and impact for business. So I'm going to give you two examples. People say, well, 100 employees or more, that's big business. Those are corporations. No, it's not. In some instances it is, okay. But we have a lot of 100 plus employers who are not corporate America, right? There are manufacturing facilities. They're our nonprofits, our bigger nonprofits, all right? If a nonprofit has to take on the cost of testing, which they already are and have been, okay, they can't afford it. They can ill afford it. And what's the result of that going to be on their balance sheet? So that's the one thing, the cost of testing. Let me give you another example. When I talk about one size doesn't fit all with this, what if your business model is that you have 100%, before COVID even, had 100% remote workforce that's a call center. And all they do for 8 hours a day is sit in their remote office taking calls. They never interface physically with another employee. They never interface physically with a client. And you're making the business mandate a vaccine for them to what end? To regulate their social engagement on the outside, right? So these are real life implications, and the money and the time, because you know the companies now also have to give the paid time off for people to get either the testing or the vaccine, right? So the vaccine, one thing, but the testing, if you have to test, you know, two times a week and I have to pay for your time off to test if I can't do it on site. And then, you know, with testing, you've got a couple of days, you've got to wait, you know, wait for results. We don't even know what type of test. So we're waiting for the regulations to come out. And the last piece of this on the compliance side, we just don't want to see gotchas. The last thing we want is OSHA coming in and doing an audit of a company who's trying their darnest, right, to do this. But remember that hiring challenge I talked about? By default, we are going to have a portion of our population that's going to choose not to vaccinate for whatever reason, whether you agree with it or not. That's the harsh reality. So now when I have to mandate, if I have to fire somebody who's in a critical position because they don't want to comply with my policy, there is not five people waiting in the wings to take that position. There's not even one person waiting in the wings to take that position. And so what's going to happen when we have to terminate or see people quit because they disagree with these policies and there's no workforce? There is an example of this. There is a hospital in New York, I think it's like Brooklyn, where they stopped delivering babies because half their workforce in that unit left because of the policy. Wow. Right. So this is real. These are the challenges we bring to our policymakers. We say, what are you going to do to work with us on the other side of this to help ease the workforce challenges that this is creating?
Yeah. And you just wonder, as you say those things, and just many other examples that you can think of, if that American CARES Act funds, I mean, you would think if you're going to put out a policy on, or some sort of mandate on private businesses, that you would be funding it as well, at least partially, yeah. Right? Or else, it, like to your point, it's being taken on by the employers until otherwise. I'm sure it's still being worked on. That's fair. So people are taking
We've said, you know, use some of that Rescue Act money to reimburse for the testing. Also, we want a strong statement from the governor that if you choose to quit your job because you don't want to comply with this government mandate, you will be ineligible for unemployment. We need that to be said, right? The presumption should be that you are ineligible, and the employee can appeal then if they feel that there was some circumstance that they should otherwise be eligible. But DOL thus far has said this will be on a case-by-case basis. You know, we want people to be disincentivized to use this as a reason to go on unemployment. And one more thing on unemployment, our unemployment insurance fund, right, owes $1 billion back to the federal government. And we've now put that tax on our New Jersey businesses for the next 3 years. 30 other states are using their Rescue Act money or have used their CARES Act money to help to offset some of that. We're not saying pay it all, right? But offset some of that, because you know what? New Jersey employers did not shut down of their own volition. They shut down because government told them to. They put their workforce on hiatus because government shut them down. And we were the last state to reopen and bring business and jobs back, right? We didn't create the unemployment crisis. Why are we as business owners paying for it? Not
That's
fair.
Great point. And sounds like you're advocating for that. To, it's,
yes. Yes.
That part's not over yet. Well, the initial decision, I guess, has been made, but I've seen other comments, you know, bipartisan, you could say, and just other organizations stepping up to make that statement in terms of putting that American CARES Act towards funds towards the instead of the income tax hike to replenish the unemployment fund in New Jersey. So do we have a chance of that being kind of overturned a little bit based on what you're seeing?
Well, the tax goes into effect October 1st, which is only some days away at this point.
Oh, wow.
In the harsh reality, we don't think we're going to see it in this first year because the legislature would have to come back in session before the election. And it appears they're not going to do that, despite the bipartisan calls to do that. But we will continue to advocate for years 2 and 3 for that relief if we don't get it in year 1. So that fight is long far from not over.
Got it. Very good. And I just had like one or two other things, but obviously if there's things that you wanted to bring up that you're seeing, like to hear those as well as we wrap up here. But just, I know it's a big topic and we could probably do a whole segment on it, but just your quick take on, and it's not even final, I guess, but you have the $1 trillion infrastructure, you know, federal bill, and then the $3 trillion. Let's just, I don't know if we could go with the one. What's your take on, obviously, I know you're big on infrastructure. I know there's a lot, it's factual evidence and research that infrastructure, returns more than money spent on it. New Jersey, you know, we just saw with Tropical Storm Ida and other events around the state, how fragile some of our infrastructure is on top of, other roads, bridges and things that were in the bill. So what's your take on the infrastructure bill? It's a lot of spending that's happened in the last couple of years, like 10, maybe, again, I don't want to mess this up, but about tenfold or more of the Great Recession. So what's your take on the infrastructure bill? And we need it, how much? And are you a fan of it?
Yeah, so there's two, right? There's two pieces to the bill, right? So infrastructure, yes, but with one caveat, again, it has to be pure infrastructure, you know, bricks and sticks. People are trying to make an argument that infrastructure, you know, has, there's societal infrastructure as well. Okay. And not that I'm opposed to some of the things that are discussed, just not to be funded by bonding in this type of money. Like it just doesn't, you know, we can't go back to the money tree and just keep, you know, giving out money. We're so indebted as a state and as a country. I tell you, I feel really bad for the generations to come on what they're going to be picking up from our debt service. But the other side of the bill, though, is what really, really concerns us is the tax bills. Because as we know, New Jersey is already the highest tax state in the nation. And if you look at the tax implications of that bill relative to New Jersey's citizens from a individual tax structure, as well as a corporate tax structure, New Jersey today is the highest corporate business tax in the nation. If that federal bill goes through, New Jersey as a state will be the highest corporate business tax in the world.
Really?
Yes, really. Okay.
I think last time we were together, you gave us an in the world statistic about, I think it was like PhDs and engineers. We have the most per capita. Do we still have that at least in the world?
Oh, absolutely. We could talk about New Jersey positives all the time. We have the most engineers and PhDs per square mile in the
that's
world.
That's what it was. So we'd have the highest corporate business tax if this goes through when you add up kind of how it boils, comes down to the
and that's not the one thing you want to brag about going, we're number one. No.
Exactly. But people are living here and moving here and paying for quality of life stuff. So hopefully that continues as it has. I have like one last question that somebody asked me to ask you just about yourself. But before we get to that, is there anything else you want to leave us with before I ask you the last question?
I think I just want to say that some people tell me that I take my job too seriously because I'm just so passionate about standing up for the business community and helping to protect their interest. You know, we got a lot of challenging things going on in this state, and the last 18 months only exacerbated. You know, my heart bleeds each and every day for how just the typical Main Street business is trying to hang on. And I'm saddened when I see literally every day a new story of a business that just decided to shut it down. And some personal examples of, you know, institutional places that I've known, you know, for years that just said, I'm tired and I can't do this anymore. I don't have a workforce and I'm old and I can't run this business myself anymore. So, you know, it's been really challenging. I just want folks to know we're out there fighting the good fight. We win a lot of little battles, you know, winning the war is very difficult. But, you know, we are here mitigating bad policy each and every day, advancing awesome recommendations for our recovery that we hope folks take us up on, especially our policymakers. And we'll continue to fight that good fight on behalf of New Jersey business.
That's excellent. Well, we appreciate it. I'm sure your clients and the business world of New Jersey appreciates the advocacy and work that the NJBIA does and what you do. So thank you for that. And the last question was, would you do you see yourself ever potentially in the future in a different capacity than what you're in now? I know you, based on what you just said, you're extremely plugged into what you're doing. You obviously, I can tell that you're excited about it, and you appears that you love it. But would you ever, I mean, go into, I don't know, would it be into politics and some economic capacity or into the private sector? Is there something like that that I'm not, and just anecdotally down the road, is that something that you could be interested in?
So I'll just tell you, you know, I'm an attorney by trade. I've been in private practice. I've worked for, you know, a company in an executive position. I obviously worked in government, and I'm back advocating on behalf of the, you know, the business community. And the number one thing I enjoy doing is being, you know, being an advocate. You know, I am a policy person. I believe in data, and I do believe that comprehensive solutions take a long time to accomplish, but it's worth it. Right. So I love what I do. You know, my life, my trajectory, I became a lawyer to become a judge. You can see I'm a little off that career path. Right. So, you know, I always have my eyes open for good opportunities. I've been fortunate enough. I work really, really hard, but I've had great opportunities presented to me throughout my career, you know, that brings me here. And, you know, you just never know what the future holds for you. But I love what I do today. And the business community needs NJBIA and a strong voice out there on their behalf. So here we are.
All right. Perfect. Well, thank you again, Michelle. We really appreciate it. Thank you for everything that you do again, and for coming on and speaking to us. One of the smartest people that I've spoke to in terms of getting the lay of the land of what's going on in New Jersey, specifically here at home in the state of New Jersey, in our small businesses specifically, and also having an eye towards what's coming down the, you know, federally and what's happening around the globe even. So thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ryan. Continue to be well.
All right, take care. Bye.
Where the talk is real. Garden State Debate. No joke, no frills. Garden State Debate. It's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate. For people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate.
Garden State Debate.
Garden State Debate.